prepara las palomitas. Está a punto de empezar En Sincronía, el podcast hispanoamericano de traducción audiovisual, con Damián Santilli, Blanca Arias Badía y Guillermo Parra.
Les damos la bienvenida al episodio número 28 de En Sincronía, el primer podcast de traducción audiovisual del mundo. Soy Damián Santilli y estoy sincronizado desde Buenos Aires, Argentina, con Blanca Arias Badía en Barcelona y Guillermo Parra en Menorca. Hola, Blanca.
Hola, ¿cómo estás, Damián?
Bien, muy bien, todo muy bien. Hola, Guille.
Muy buenas. Yo en Menorca hoy, porque ayer estaba en Barcelona también, que conste.
Ah, sí, sí. ¿Cómo fue? ¿Cómo salió todo eso?
Muy bien, el festival fue un lujazo. Tocó proyectar subtítulos, tocó hacer todas esas cosas que explicamos en el último episodio.
Entrevistas también, todo un poco.
Sí, hubo que interpretar también a invitados y demás. Estuvo estuvo interesante.
Completito.
Está muy bien. ¿Y vos, Blanca, cómo andás?
Bien, aquí no sé si en Argentina pasa lo mismo, aquí el tiempo está absolutamente loco. Esta mañana teníamos un tormentón y ahora hay un sol radiante. Y nada, yo en concreto pues con los efectos secundarios de una vacuna que me está dejando un poco zombie, pero aparte de eso todo bien.
Dios mío, hay que elegir bien el momento para vacunarse porque si no se complica demasiado.
No hay momento bueno para que te pase esto.
Bueno, un solo que te parece el fin de semana, qué sé yo. Bueno, muy bien. Antes de avanzar, tenemos que hablarles de nuestro patrocinador Una, la mejor herramienta en línea para creación, traducción y edición de subtítulos y closed caption para todos los idiomas. Una tiene una interfaz muy intuitiva y fácil de usar que nos permite trabajar como profesionales de la manera más sencilla. Pueden ingresar en una.net para probar el software gratis durante 4 semanas, mejorar su productividad y empezar a trabajar como profesionales hoy mismo. Y hoy tenemos un episodio muy especial, nuestro segundo episodio, nuestra segunda entrevista en inglés con, bueno, nada más ni nada menos que Aline Remal y Nina Reviers. Blanca, contanos un poquito acerca de ellas para quienes no las conocen.
Pues sí, Damián, hoy tenemos a Aline Remal y a Nina Reviers. La doctora Aline Remal es catedrática emérita de teoría de la traducción, de interpretación y de traducción audiovisual en el Departamento de Lingüística Aplicada y de Traducción e Interpretación de la Universidad de Amberes, y ha publicado muchos trabajos sobre traducción audiovisual. Es, por ejemplo, coautora junto con Jorge Díaz Cintas de los conocidos manuales que sé que tú recomiendas tanto, Damián, en tus cursos: Audiovisual Translation Subtitling en el 2007 y Subtitling Concepts and Practices en el 2021, que se utilizan pues en todo el mundo.
Más conocido como la Biblia del subtitulado.
Exacto, es autora de la Biblia, la persona a la que tenemos hoy. También ha participado en muchos proyectos internacionales, como por ejemplo el proyecto Erasmus Plus Accessible Culture and Training, ACT, que dirigió la Universidad Autónoma de Barcelona, o Audio Description, a Laboratory for the Development of a New Professional Profile, que es más conocido como AdLab Pro, que se dirigió desde la Universidad de Trieste. Y bueno, aparte de estos proyectos, muchos otros, y seguro que en la entrevista nos va a ir contando más cosas. En cuanto a Nina Reviers, es doctora en estudios de traducción por la Universidad de Amberes, terminó el doctorado en el 2018. Sus intereses de investigación son la audiodescripción de espectáculos en directo, la docencia de la audiodescripción, los aspectos lingüísticos de la audiodescripción, la multimodalidad y los estudios de corpus. Y nos va a hablar de todo esto en la entrevista. Es coordinadora de OPEN, que es un centro sobre accesibilidad, y espero que también nos lo presente un poquito. Y miembro del comité organizador de Languages and the Media.
Muy bien, muy bien. Y bueno, además, por supuesto, de nuestras entrevistadas de hoy, vamos a tener nuestras secciones. Hoy, Blanca, vamos a comenzar con los minutos divulgativos.
Pues yo no puedo contenerme ya de hablar del nuevo manual que va a salir en Routledge sobre audiodescripción. No sé si sabéis que hay Routledge Handbooks de absolutamente todo. Sí. Pues el Routledge Handbook de audiodescripción está a punto de salir.
¡Qué buena noticia!
Va a ponerse a la venta el 7 de abril, así que os voy a contar un poquito qué se podrá encontrar en este manual. Y nada, estoy muy contenta de haber participado y os diré un poquito qué se podrá encontrar.
Muy bien, muy bien. Y después de la primera parte de la entrevista tendremos los subtítulos con carácter Guille.
Pues los subtítulos con carácter, yo hablaré de un tema mucho menos trascendental que el nuevo manual de Routledge, eso hay que decirlo. Pero la película Turning Red, que es el último estreno de Pixar, que está ahora disponible en Disney Plus, que curiosamente en Latinoamérica se conoce como Volviéndose Rojo, y en España se quedó en Red, a secas. Y ese Red me hace gracia porque no dicen Red en toda la película. Debe ser una de esas tantas decisiones de marketing que nos afectan a los traductores. Y nada, pues yo hablaré de los subtítulos de la película en Disney Plus.
Uh-huh. Muy bien, muy bien. Y después de la segunda parte de la entrevista tendremos el laboratorio visual. Hoy, después de hablar mucho de software gratuito, vamos a hablar de software pago. Y vamos a charlar de cómo incrustar subtítulos con Camtasia, que es una de las herramientas de edición de video más prácticas y más útiles y más usadas en el mercado. Así que de eso va a tratar nuestro laboratorio en el día de hoy. Y sin mucha más introducción, vamos a comenzar el episodio con los minutos divulgativos.
En este podcast no nos gusta que la investigación sobre traducción audiovisual y accesibilidad se quede guardada en un cajón. Empiezan los minutos divulgativos con Blanca Arias Badía.
Hola, como os avanzaba en la introducción, tenemos una novedad importantísima en el ámbito de la traducción audiovisual bibliográfica, que es el nuevo manual de Routledge sobre audiodescripción que han editado conjuntamente Chris Taylor y Elisa Perego. Lo vais a tener disponible a partir del 7 de abril y os dejaré en la cajita de información de YouTube el enlace por si tenéis interés. Se trata de un manual que tiene 38 capítulos, así que no me voy a detener en todos. Pero sí que os digo que son capítulos firmados por personas que llevan muchos años trabajando sobre la audiodescripción. Algunas de ellas las hemos conocido en el podcast, como por ejemplo a Pablo Romero Fresco, a Pilar Orero, a Ana Matamala, a Karma Mangirón. Nuestras invitadas del episodio de hoy firman conjuntamente también un capítulo sobre audiodescripción y teatro. Y hay muchísimos temas que se abordan y que creo que pueden ser de vuestro interés, desde programario que se usa para la audiodescripción, hasta el uso de voces artificiales en la audiodescripción, la intersección con el audio subtitulado, cómo funciona, cuál es el perfil profesional de los audiodescriptores de hoy en día. Yo he tenido el honor de participar en este manual, en el segundo capítulo que firmo conjuntamente con Joan Josep Bestarbou, y en el que hablamos del marco social y legislativo que promueve y que da lugar a un servicio como la audiodescripción, con especialmente movimientos desde el tercer sector, desde el activismo, de las organizaciones sin ánimo de lucro dedicadas a velar por los intereses de las personas ciegas y con baja visión. Os animo a leer el capítulo para que tengáis la información completa, pero no quiero despedirme sin daros algunas fechas y datos de cosas que han ido pasando durante el siglo XX y que son muy relevantes desde el punto de vista de la audiodescripción. 1929 es el año en el que se ofrece la primera audiodescripción en Nueva York. Asisten como invitados los miembros de una entidad dedicada a las personas ciegas. 1944, en el discurso anual de la Federación de las Personas Ciegas, el activista Ten Broek reivindica que las personas ciegas deben alzar su voz porque solo ellas son capaces de explicar exactamente cuáles son sus intereses. Y para nosotros esto es el preludio de lo que acabaría siendo el mensaje Nothing About Us Without Us, que se ha expandido tanto en el mundo del activismo de la discapacidad. 1948, Declaración de los Derechos Humanos, esta seguramente ya os lo sabíais, pero muy interesante. En 1949 se funda la organización que luego daría lugar a la Organización Mundial de Ciegos en los años 80, el World Council for the Welfare of the Blind, que enseguida empieza a hablar de servicios como las bibliotecas de libros parlantes. ¿A qué os recuerdan? Si como a nosotros os recuerdan a los audiolibros, fijaros que empiezan como un servicio de accesibilidad claramente orientado a las personas ciegas y se han acabado convirtiendo en un servicio mainstream. Ojalá que eso pase con muchos otros servicios, porque eso sin duda promueve la accesibilidad. Sigo con las fechas. 1976. Manifiesto de la UPIAS, que es la Unión de las Personas con Discapacidad Física de Reino Unido, que se ha considerado uno de los momentos clave para que se empezara a concebir la discapacidad desde un punto de vista social. En este nuevo marco, cualquier desventaja a la que se enfrenta una persona con discapacidad se debe a cómo está construida y organizada la sociedad y no a las condiciones del individuo en cuestión. En los años 80 se expande la idea de accesibilidad a ámbitos como la planificación urbana, el transporte, la comunicación, y de hecho es la década en la que empezamos a tener más noticias de audiodescripción en distintos países. En realidad, la concepción social de la discapacidad se ha desarrollado más y se habla incluso de una concepción relacionada con los derechos humanos que se consolida, y esto nos lleva a la última fecha importante ya en el siglo XXI, en el 2006, con la aprobación en la ONU de la Convención Internacional sobre los Derechos de las Personas con Discapacidad. Según esta concepción, las personas con discapacidad se perciben como sujetos activos con los mismos derechos que las personas sin discapacidad, en lugar de ser receptores pasivos de servicios como la audiodescripción. Precisamente lo que quiere nuestro capítulo es reforzar la idea de que las personas con discapacidad han sido de hecho promotoras de la audiodescripción desde el principio, porque la han reivindicado y la han solicitado. Sin esta reivindicación probablemente no habríamos llegado a donde estamos hoy. Bueno, hasta aquí y nos vemos en los próximos minutos divulgativos.
Hello. It's our pleasure to have Dr. Aline Rebael and Dr. Nina Reviers here with us today. This is the second Ensynchronia interview we are holding in English, so again, bear with us until we have some more practice. May I call you by your first name in this interview? We tend to do so in Spanish.
Yes, of course, fine.
Yes, for me too.
Thank you. Welcome to the podcast. So, our listeners are ABT students, practitioners, scholars with different career paths, and we found that they really like to know how it all started for our guests at the podcast. So I wanted to start by asking, perhaps Aline, you could start by telling us what motivated your interest in ABT, and also when did media accessibility come in?
Okay, thank you for that question. It's a bit of personal history, really.
We like that.
Yeah. No. The juicy parts, right?
Exactly.
Well, it's not that juicy, but my interest in AVT stems from an interest in translation issues generally on the one hand and film on the other hand. Because my PhD was in screenwriting as an intermediate translation in film adaptations from novels and plays into motion pictures. And I focused on the role of film dialogue in that, which was neglected in film studies at the time. So the step from dialogues to subtitling was not a very big one. And then especially the role played by the interaction between dialogues and images and sound. So I've always been interested in these interactions between the different constituents of multimodality. And that's also how my interest in audio description came about, with which we started in the early 2000s at the University of Antwerp, and with subtitling in 1990s, maybe 1993 or so. Yeah.
Thank you. What about you, Nina?
Well, actually, I got to know AVT through my studies at University of Antwerp with teachers like Aline. I actually started my study wanting to be an interpreter, but then there were subtitling classes, and then I was looking for a topic for my thesis, and I went to Aline as my supervisor, and she mentioned this new thing called audio description, which I then did for my master thesis, description in the theater, and I was immediately hooked and interested by this thing, audio description. It fascinated me. It combined a very creative type of translation with my interest in speaking that I had from interpreting as well, particularly for live AD for the theater. So my research also started not first AVT and then ME, but MA, but immediately with media accessibility and audio description in particular. So it was through Aline that I was introduced to the field.
Yeah, we wanted to bring you two together today, even though you have different paths, of course, because actually you have published a lot together and we know that you've been in many projects together. So we really wanted to see these two perspectives. And Even though we won't be discussing interpreting a lot today, I think we should start by telling you that you will be invited again to this podcast to talk about interpreting because you have so much to tell us. So, okay. But now moving on, in one of these papers that you've written together, in this case also with Reinhild van der Verhoeven, there's one, there's this paper entitled From Translation Studies and Audiovisual Translation to Media Accessibility, Some Research Trends. And we've been discussing this with some other guests, such as Pablo Romero Fresco. So we wanted to have your view on one question, which is, do you now, after all of these years of research, think of media accessibility as part of audiovisual translation or the opposite or neither of these options? So, for example, I don't know, who wants to start? Whoever wants to start.
I don't know. Shall I go, Nina?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Okay. Yes, it's a topic that's much debated these days, but it's not one that is foremost on my mind. And the main reason is that both audiovisual translation and media accessibility are changing constantly and are changing quickly. And I think the interactions between the two are also important, that one influences the other, and also that modes that once were considered audiovisual translation through the interaction of different factors have somehow become media accessibility and the other way around, like subtitling for deaf and hard of hearing people. These subtitles are used by everybody. So is it no longer accessibility? Is it now audiovisual translation? I think this is in a constant flux and changing as we speak. On the other hand, you could say, I think, that translation makes texts or events, if it's a live event, accessible. And any form of translation is semiotic translation. And that then means, I think, that media accessibility is a form of translation, because if any translation is semiotic translation, it would include also media accessibility. On the other hand, I think it's very important to stress that media accessibility is also changing and entering the creative process. So when it enters the creative process, is it then still media accessibility? So I think it's one that's very difficult to get out of or to clarify once and for all.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that one. I think in the beginning there was a lot of discussion to try to prove or argument that media accessibility was a type of translation, a specific type. But today there's so many perspectives, and I think media accessibility is indeed AVT, it's also translation, depending on what angle you approach it, but it also has other aspects. Like Aline already said, it's often or more and more being studied as part of artistic creation. So is it then still translation or something else? I think there's also a trend these days to study media accessibility in its larger social context. And often an accessible performance is about more than just making the content accessible. It's also the context that needs to be accessible. And that is about more than translation alone. I think Nivesh has this nice concept she recently published about achievement spaces. You know, it's about creating a space where everybody can participate. And translation is part of that, but not the only thing. So from that angle, it is translation, but also more. So it can be many things depending on the angle from which you decide to research it, I think.
Could I add something to that still?
Of course, of course.
I think a problem that translation has always had since the beginning is that lay people, people out there who use translations all the time, have very conservative ideas of what translation is. And to some extent, that is still the case. You ask anybody out there, what's a translation? And they say, oh, that's transferring a text from English into French, for instance. And now translation is diversifying to such an extent. I think it's important, not just for accessibility, but also for all these new forms of translation, to involve the public, to some extent, I think we have to inform and maybe even train the public and the users of translation to know what they can expect and what they can't expect, and also ask what they want from translation and accessibility. Because I think people really don't always get what they expect or don't know what to expect. And that's becoming more and more complicated. With Joselia's concept, for instance, you can never translate everything. If translation becomes translation, not only of visual and audio, but also of what you can feel or smell, how many people will expect that? So I think we need to do a lot of, make a lot of publicity about what we do and how we do it and why we do it. We are too much in our ivory tower, I think.
I think we could finish the interview with this reflection, actually, because I think it's so interesting and we could stop here like for very, very long. I will share this publication you mentioned from Neves so that all listeners can have a look if they want to. So thank you for that. And yes, we have many times talked about how important it is to train and to inform also customers for practitioners and in the area of research, as you were saying. I think it is the same. So making this diversification, making the public aware of this diversification that you were mentioning, I think would be key. So thank you. In order to know some more about you two, could you tell us about what you're up to now? So what is your present situation and which projects are you involved at now? Thanks. For example, Nina, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think Aline and me are representing two ends of the spectrum of an academic career. I'm the just starting out in my academic career. I finished my PhD in 2018 and then started in 2019, late 2019, as a tenure track lecturer at the University of Antwerp. So I'm very much starting my projects, getting my first PhD students to supervise and focusing mainly on audio description. On the one hand, audio description for theater and the performing arts and the arts, more live types of theaters. And then also working with a PhD student now on automatic translation and translation of audio description. And then on the other hand, as part of my research, I also very much try to focus on collaboration with industry and with users and with our more action research projects, if you will. Also helping to promote accessibility in practice, even though I do research, that's also something I like to focus on.
Mm-hmm. Aline, what about you?
Well, yes, I'm retired. And
are you really retired or fake retired? Like so many people we know in academia who are really active anyway.
No, I'm kind of retired. I retired on the 1st of February 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I kept doing a number of things. I made sure that the PhDs I was still supervising finished, and they're all finished now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, of course, a professor emeritus, which means I can still do things for the university, and I still have my email address and all that and all the facilities. But in a way, I've become a backbencher. So what I do is I'm still external examiner for PhDs. I'm in numerous committees. I'm in advisory boards for projects and for different publications. I'm guest editing with Mary Carroll. I'm guest editing an issue of YAT, Journal of Audiovisual Translation, as you probably know.
Mm-hmm. I know.
And other things like that. So I'm very interested in keeping up with things and providing support in the form of editing and advisory boards and the like. In terms of research, I'm most interested in reading things related to the borders between translation and creation now in audiovisual translation.
Mm-hmm.
Actually taken part in an exhibition in Brussels. They invited me to take part in an exhibition of artists who use subtitling in a very controversial way, or who use it in their art, not as subtitling something else, but as the essence of their art. And I wrote a creative text about subtitling for that, and I found that a very interesting challenge. So it's like it's something between a rhythmical poem and an essay.
Mm-hmm.
So these things I feel I have more time now to devote to, because unlike Nina, I don't have to meet these deadlines. So you can actually work on what you really want to work on.
I wanted to ask you whether this text you wrote is publicly available, because I'm curious, and I guess many of us are.
Yeah, I think it's still online, because due to COVID, it was an online exhibition of a gallery in Brussels. And yeah, I can find it and send you the link. I think it might still be there. I'm not sure.
Okay, perfect. If you send it to us, we will also post it with the information of the episode, and so that people can have a look.
Okay.
Okay, and can you tell us, perhaps Nina, who was not talking now, about TRIX? What is TRIX?
Yes, TRIX is it stands for Translation, Interpreting and Intercultural Studies, and it is the research group, the name of the research group of the Department of Applied Linguistics, Translators and Interpreters of the University of Antwerp. So it's the research group that we are both part of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a research group that's, I think, a good representative sample of the different types of subfields within translation studies. It houses the AVT and MA group at our department, but there's also a researcher in literary translation studies, interpreting studies, applied linguistics or applied translation studies, anthropological approaches. So very varied but dynamic group at our department.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you both are part of TRIX. We will also post the information about this group so that people can become familiar with it. And Aline was telling us that she's co-editing a special issue at JAT, the Journal of Audiovisual Translation. We talked about that in the episode with Sharon Black and Rula Sokoli.
Mm-hmm.
So in principle, our listeners should be very law-abiding and know what the Journal of Audiovisual Translation is, but we will also post some information. I wanted to ask you what OPEN is, because when I introduced you, I said that you are involved in OPEN. So Nina, if you can explain that a little bit.
Yeah, maybe Aline, you can start on how it started OPEN.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, yes, gladly. Mm-hmm. At some point, the department, and then especially TRIX and the people working in media accessibility and AVT in TRIX, were getting so many requests for information and help and input about how do I make a performance accessible, what is audio description, and so on and so forth, that I thought it might be a good idea to create not an institution, but some format that would allow us to devote more time to such questions, and also to link such questions to research that we are doing, so that we would be able to create a win-win situation for people requiring accessibility or translation, for people wishing to start with it and not knowing how, and for us to make our research known and to receive input for our research. And I discussed this at the time with Nina and another colleague, Gertrud Kauteren. We discussed it at the public broadcaster and with a few people from blind associations who were all very enthusiastic. And then, to cut a very long story short, we somehow managed to transfer this enthusiasm to our faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the rector or the vice chancellor of the university, who then provided us with funding to start the Open Center, the Expertise Center for Accessible Media and Culture. and gave us funding for one full-time manager and a part-time administrator. And this was the year before I became an emeritus, to use a nice word, rather than retiree. And so Nina took over. And I still don't know how we managed to do that. It's a little miracle. Because universities usually say no, and then suddenly they said yes. And there we go. Nina had a full-time job and more. So over to you, Nina.
Yeah. So I think it's been 3 years now that we have the expertise center. And mainly we try to be a point of contact between the different stakeholders, bring people into contact, give advice, also, you know, keep in touch with where the research needs lie in society, and also organize activities. We just had the open forum and the unlimited conference and organize workshops. And it's been, it's been really great to keep the connection between academia, but also what's going on in practice, to keep that dialogue alive.
Yeah, we've been discussing that with other guests such as Frederic Chaume and Jorge Diaz Cintas, so how important it is to keep this contact. So I see you're all on the same line. I wanted to ask also both of you, but we've seen Nina is in the steering committee of the Languages and the Media Conference. So if you want to tell us how this, when you learned this, how this happened. I mean, are you happy with this? Is it a lot of work?
No, obviously I was very honored when I was asked to join the steering committee. I think it's been 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a bit of a rocky start since the first conference I was involved in to give input for was then postponed and then postponed again, and then it went online. But now we had the first online conference of languages and the media. Now we're preparing the next one, which will be in November in Berlin. I'm very excited to start to work on this. Hopefully see everyone again in November.
Is it planned to be on site or online?
For now, it's planned on site.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's keep optimistic.
We've learned to be careful. So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, I've asked this question because I think it's something that everyone is wondering, even if they have sent abstracts or are just planning to attend. I think many people don't know.
Yeah. I refer everyone to the website for official communication. I do hope that it will be a great seeing each other again in November.
Were there many, perhaps you are not participating in that part of the organization, but since I think the deadline closed recently, did you have lots of applications, or was it similar to other years? Do you have some data on that? people might be curious.
I don't have any data on that. No, I know that registration's closed, and that we'll now start looking into all the submissions. But I have no idea how many or what the statistics are.
Okay. We will learn them at a later stage. No problem.
Yeah, everybody will have to be patient.
Okay. So now we would like to divide the rest of the interview in two parts. We will be discussing subtitling and audio description. And let's start with subtitling. And let me address Aline directly. For those listeners who don't know, Aline has been a pioneer in the study of subtitling, as well as of other AVT modalities, as we've already mentioned. And actually, she was awarded the Jan Iverson Award in 2018 for her services to the field of audiovisual translation. So I wanted to ask you, which have been your main areas of interest within subtitling, let's say, from the beginning? You were now telling us about the most recent ones, but in general, in your career, which aspects have you been focusing on? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I have to look back a bit for that, because more recently I've been active in accessibility more. But My interest in subtitling has always been connected somehow with the relationships between spoken and written language. And in 2007, Jorge and I published Audiovisual Translation Subtitling. So at the time, my research was practice directed, and I feel that in 2007, we really filled a gap. Lots and lots of institutions of higher education and elsewhere, people were starting subtitling courses, and there wasn't really a book available. So we thought it was the right time. We were actually contacted by a publisher who then published our book. So I concentrated on how does subtitling work, the linguistics of subtitling, the semiotics of subtitling, but also the technicalities such as reading speed and all that. And that then yielded this book in 2007. So that was based on practical research I had been doing before that time, since the early 90s, also for my teaching, of course, because I was teaching subtitling. And being one of the pioneers, there wasn't very much available. I already collaborated with the public broadcaster. So I had people, subtitlers from the broadcaster, who came over to give talks. My students went over there to see how it worked in real life. And that's how it all started in the beginning. Now, I don't know if you know, but I'm also an interpreter. And that's also, again, a link with different types of spoken and written language, because that led me to an interest in live subtitling. Mm-hmm. And we introduced that very early at the University of Antwerp. First, intralingual live subtitling, and then also interlingual live subtitling, which is very close to interpreting. Apart from that, my interest in subtitling after the more practical input from the beginning was always a bit ideologically or sociologically oriented. For instance, I studied the impact of deletions in subtitling on film dialogue. So how does it impact characterization? And that was, of course, based on research I'd done in film dialogue before. Another project that I did locally with people from the University of Antwerp looked in intralingual subtitling in Flanders, where we have the tendency to subtitle people who don't speak perfect general Dutch, let's say, standard Dutch. So anyone who has a slight accent or speaks a bit of dialect is subtitled into Dutch, so Dutch into Dutch. We also subtitle the Dutch from the Netherlands, of course. And in some ways, this we found very patronizing. So we had a major project where we studied a large data set of subtitled material to identify who was subtitled, when they were subtitled, who was not subtitled, and how they were subtitled. So that yielded a number of publications, also with a slightly sociological or sociolinguistic slant. In the meantime, of course, they keep doing this. And in the meantime, I think it's not so bad, because now migrants are using these subtitles, even if we don't need them, because we are perfectly capable of understanding most dialects, other people are not. So in the meantime, my view on this has changed. I don't find them so patronizing anymore, because they serve a different function. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Does that give you an idea?
It does, even though I would like to know more, but we need to move on, sadly. But it is really interesting, and I think we will need to share some of these publications on, for example, re-speaking, because they have been key to the discipline. So I think listeners will enjoy them a lot. Now that you are retired, I know that you've said now for the last years you've focused more on accessibility, but actually subtitling is part of accessibility. So what is your view on how the discipline has or hasn't, I guess it has, changed over the past two decades, especially when it perhaps boomed? What do you think about that? Because we've had different ideas on that from professors who have been guests at the podcast. So we would like to hear from you as well.
I think that's a very difficult question because subtitling has changed so much, and then in some ways it hasn't. Mm-hmm. So I find the question very, very broad, and I think I would need 2 hours to cover it, which is definitely not what we want. But let me say what I think are major factors. Mm-hmm. So first of all, it has become much more widespread, and it is used on many more platforms. It is divulged and created by many more technologies in many different places. So it has become much broader. It has a much broader reach, which is also only possible because of a greater degree of commercialization. So the economy has played a role in that. This has positive and negative impacts on subtitling. Definitely often has negative impacts on those who subtitle and earn less. It has positive impacts on the amount of subtitling and that can be produced and the amount of content that can be made accessible through subtitling. So I think the digitization and the technology behind it have been very important in that sense. But they have also been important in the way they have made subtitling a more creative mode. Mm-hmm. It has enabled fan subbing, has enabled people who want to promote a good cause online to subtitle their materials. So the fact that technology has become available for more people has also made subtitling more democratic and more creative because it takes on many different forms. On the other hand, a new tendency, I find that filmmakers are now also using subtitles in their films, not as subtitles, or sometimes they are, but as part of their creative product. And that has been, I think, a very important development because it has shown that not all filmmakers find it disturbing to have text on screen, which was one of the old problems with subtitling. It makes the image ugly. No, they actually create films with subtitling. Only they look different. They are colorful. They move around on the screen. And that, again, has made it possible to do the same in what is normally traditional subtitling. So I think all these developments have pros and cons and are all linked. I think one development promotes another and causes yet another, and so on and so forth. So it's a constant semiosis, if you like. Different forms creating different meanings, creating more different forms. And all the actors that come into it are important, whether it is the person subtitling, the user, the activists, the people who need the subtitle, the people who make money out of it, those who would like to make money out of it, etc. Right, how is that for a start?
That is a lot for a start. Okay. I was thinking when you mentioned that film directors actually introduce subtitles in a creative way, I was thinking of, you know this PhD student who is working with Pablo Romero Fresco, Rocío Varela.
Yes.
Yes. I think she has written an overview of the evolution of that in film history, if I'm not wrong. So I hope that will be published at some point and we will all be able to have a look at that. Mm-hmm. So thank you. That was a lot for a start. And you have actually already mentioned how you build and also in teaching how you've built up. Sorry, I have a question for Aline before that. Mm-hmm. We like to ask sometimes who trained the people who we all think have trained us through the literature in this matter. So who taught you subtitling or interpreting, if that you think was key, or were you self-taught at the time? Or?
To some extent. I visited the public broadcaster several times where I got demonstrations of how it was done. And then at the time, actually at the University of Ghent, they were already teaching subtitling as an undergraduate course, mostly because they subtitled the Ghent Film Festival. And they trained their students mostly to subtitle the film festival at the time. So I contacted the person teaching there and I went and took his classes. So I learned subtitling with the undergraduates in Ghent. That was 1 or 2 years before I started teaching it myself. So that's how I learned subtitling.
Okay.
I did train as an interpreter. So that then led me to try out re-speaking. We actually introduced re-speaking as an experiment. So a colleague of mine who was also teaching interpreting at the time and who was an interpreter, Bart van der Veert, and I downloaded Dragon Naturally Speaking on our laptops, and we tried it out and have trained ourselves in re-speaking. Then got permission from the faculty or from the department to try it out with students. And we published an announcement and saying people who are interested can take this course, which doesn't actually exist. So it won't be on your diploma, but we'll give you a certificate. And 4 people applied and 4 people took our course or actually learned it with us for a year. And the next year we introduced it officially. And one of these 4 people is the head of live subtitling at one of the commercial broadcasters now in Flanders. So it's really very often personal initiative that starts things off.
I see. Okay. Thank you. And so we were now discussing these changes in the discipline, and I wanted to know your opinions, actually, from both of you. You have said that you always try also in teaching to build bridges between academia and the industry, not only between these 2 stakeholders, but also users. So I wanted to know how you see this connection today. So perhaps Nina, if you want to start.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think that what Aline just said already showed how important it is, you know, this connection in the translation process. So many agents are indeed involved. So it, you know, it goes to say that also in our research, keeping these connections strong is important. I think working together with users and industry has always been important in the field of media accessibility. And even today, as things get more complex, it is increasingly important. On the one hand, for academia to keep in touch with, you know, what the real needs are in practice that we should focus our research on, but also for industry, particularly when it comes to media accessibility, to keep the user, you know, in the frame and keep the concerns for quality high, because media accessibility is, you know, first and foremost about social rights and human rights. So it's important to not only look for the, you know, financial gains or possibilities, and I think their industry and academia can strengthen each other. I think there's also another group of stakeholders that's usually not immediately mentioned, but Aline also mentioned them, and they're becoming more important now, and those are the makers of audiovisual products, directors and artists that are getting more involved in audiovisual translation and media accessibility, integrating in their work from the start. So I think that's also another, you know, non-academic group that's very important to work with. And I also think that you know, there's also the users, obviously, always been an important group in media accessibility to take on board in our research and in practice. But I think there's also changes going on these past years. Very recently, in particular, users have always been involved, but mostly in a more passive role, giving feedback or input on practices and on research. But I think today there's voices that highlight the importance to reach through participation. It's important to involve users in all aspects of content creation, on the one hand, but also in research, how do we involve users and the voice of people with the lived experience of a disability in how we design our research from the start as co-researchers?
Yes.
But it's sometimes a difficult exercise in self-reflection, because we have to ask ourselves how accessible our universities are, which I think there's, we research accessibility, but our university environment is not accessible yet in many ways. I recently got an email from a colleague in Belgium that there's now this Dutch initiative, Accessible Academia, from people with researchers with a disability and also for students with a disability, to talk about the barriers that are still there. And mm-hmm. It shows how much work there's still to be done to really involve, to make sure that, the context, everybody can participate on equal footing on all levels, not just to give feedback. And I think that's very much a recent thing that we're thinking about, and that still requires a lot of work, and that, shows that working together with all the many different stakeholders remains very important.
I've seen, I would like to know more about this initiative. I had recently heard about one specifically for the deaf and promoted mm-hmm. by deaf PhD students. So I think these kind of actions are really necessary, because indeed, as you were saying, we are researching accessibility and we are not accessible. So yes, self-criticism is very important in life.
Yeah.
Moving on with subtitling, Nina, I think you were actually one of the main organizers of Unlimited, an event that was recently organized at the University of Antwerp. And I know that the focus of this event was placed on live events. I wanted to know whether you could just give us some ideas of which approaches were proposed there, which recent findings were shared, and I don't know, a very small summary of what you got there.
Yes, Unlimited in a nutshell.
yes. Also a difficult question, sorry.
No, we organized an Unlimited, which was a conference that Aline Wright started or founded in 2016, so it's every 2 years. But this year was also preceded by the Open Forum, a wider, not so much academic event, but for a variety of stakeholders the day before, that we organized with the Open Expertise Center, so it was more of a two-day thing. Main themes that were discussed. I think there was two pillars, two main things, maybe two ends of the spectrum, if you will. On the one hand, of course, technology, which is always center in our field. Technology is moving fast and constantly changing the way we provide accessibility for users, as well as for describers and the tools they work with. Different kind of technological solutions, from tactile objects for audio description, and of course also artificial intelligence for subtitling, which particularly for English live subtitling, the automatic options are becoming increasingly good. We also provided live subtitling at the conference through Respeaking, but some of the examples with the automatic captioning are actually quite impressive. So I'm very interested to see how that moves forward. But also more and more technology for live events, for theater audio description. Technology always. But on the other hand, what was also very clear was that a lot of presentation focused on the human aspect of accessibility, and stressed that you can have all of, tools and technology and services, but first and foremost, accessibility is about a mindset of welcoming people, making them feel welcome. And it's about more than just the service or about technology, but about involving them, welcoming them, the language that you use, the things that you make. So that's very much, technology, but on the other hand, not forgetting, the human social aspect of accessibility in a broader sense.
If the event was
crucially about technology, I think Damian should have been there because he's a geek when it comes to subtitling and technology. So
I think we should do another show on machine translation and all that, because they will have a lot to say, especially Nina, on that. So
yeah, I think that's a topic that can fill a whole separate podcast itself.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and people need to hear about that too.
Okay, and just to close this part where we were talking about subtitling, I want to ask Aline, since we have you here, about your handbook, Subtitling Concepts and Practices, which was published with Jorge Díaz Cintas about a year ago. You mentioned the previous handbook that you had written in 2007, but I mean, now that we have this opportunity and we have you here, I wanted to know whether you have some data on the reception of this new handbook and also about your experience as writer of the handbook. Would you write anything differently now? What are you happiest about? Or, I don't know, are you already thinking of a third volume with Jorge Díaz Cintas? Or is it too soon?
I think Jorge will kill me if I suggest it.
Go ahead. Jorge never kills any of us, so I think...
Yeah, that's true too, yeah. No, I'm quite happy with the book as it turned out, but it was a lot of work, and it was timely because the other book dated from 2007, and you all know how much changed in the meantime. I do get emails regularly from colleagues who use it, and I know it is used globally. It is used well beyond Europe, but I haven't got data accessible here. I'm expecting them soon, actually. I'm expecting the publisher will let us know soon, but I haven't had an overview. But subjectively, I've got the impression it's been well received.
We call it the Bible here in Argentina, so...
Exactly.
Okay.
You can imagine how well received it was.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear it. I hope it's easier reading than the other Bible.
Nana, we love it and we use it a lot. And I think, like you're saying, it's timely. It's timely. So I'm very glad you did it. While you are retired, you know, are you planning to write more books in your retirement? Because this is a very active retirement.
Exactly.
I'm not sure. I don't think books, no.
That's a shame.
I'm happy with this one because I think that we changed a lot. It's really a different book. It's not the same book. We just used some examples again. And... because it would be silly not to use them if they are good, you know? Mm-hmm. But the part on technology was expanded largely. Also, reconceptualizing subtitling, I thought, was an important chapter because of all the new forms that are arising, also due to technology and other issues. The professional ecosystem, I think, is really up to date and giving a lot of interesting information about the world of subtitling out there, and then technology on the move, which I must say was exclusively Jorge's, which I think is also a very good introduction to all the technology that is used today and the way it is going. But we also expanded and rewrote and added chapters about sociocultural issues, such as multilingualism, ideological matters, and also humor and ideology, which are actually connected, because what is humorous in one part of the world, as we all know, gets you killed in other parts of the world. So ideology and culture remain very important. I'm not saying technology is not, but they both are. So I think we struck a very good balance in the book between the two, covering the two, besides the basic semiotics of subtitling and all the technical and linguistic issues that any subtitler needs to know. What's also, in my view, better than in the other book is the website, where we were able to accumulate a lot of material that is useful for trainees and for trainers, mm-hmm. and a lot of links to people out there in the industry that you might want to contact or work with. So all in all, I'm satisfied with the book. The only thing I would have liked to add is more about new trends in creative subtitling, but that was quite impossible because we already had way too much. Mm-hmm. The number of pages was already more than we had, more the publisher had bargained for. So we had to limit ourselves to what you could call traditional commercial subtitling, maybe. But even so, it covers a lot, and you do need to know the basics before you can start experimenting. So as for a third book, I don't think I will write a third book. And if I did, I don't think it would again be on subtitling. Now, if you were to ask me, what do you think would be an interesting publication? Would I be allowed to answer that question?
Of course. Go ahead.
I think it would be really interesting if somebody were to write a study of the interactions, so actually a form of process research maybe, but the interactions that have produced and keep producing new forms of audiovisual translation.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one example I mentioned, how subtitling for the deaf and hard of hearing becomes subtitling used by many people, but that's a very simple example.
Mm-hmm.
Nina, I was talking to Nina earlier and we discussed how audio introductions for the theatre given live before the play were then moved to the websites and are now being integrated in podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen? It's an interplay between so many different actors. And I think we could look at the history of audiovisual translation and at the future of audiovisual translation by trying to render this network or investigate this network. Who plays a role? What's the input of legislation? What's the input of NGOs, what's the input of practitioners, of research, of the economy, of language service providers, of the creators? And this could be done in different countries for different modes. You don't have to do everything at once, but it would, I think, yield very interesting results, an interesting view on the history of audiovisual translation, how it began and evolved and why, and also where it might be going.
I think I speak on behalf of all listeners if I ask you to write that book. So please write it. Go ahead. We're waiting for the book. For the
we reading. Know what to do now, Aline. We know.
We all know what to do. You could also make it a special issue and then you wouldn't have to write everything. Just mm-hmm. edit it and ask others to write the chapters.
That's also a way to do so. Damian, I think you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to go back to the book just a little bit because I want to ask Aline something that we asked Jorge actually last year, which is I think that one of the main differences between 2007 and 2020 when your book came out, 2021, is that Netflix appeared, right? So in 2007, this book that you wrote with Jorge gave us the tools to teach and to learn and to know all the guidelines or create our own guidelines. But nowadays, I see that in many parts of the world, some people are teaching using Netflix guidelines, for instance, instead of more academic options like this one. So what I was curious about is that I wanted to know if you think that was something that you needed to consider while writing this new version of the book?
I think we did consider it, although we started working and writing on this book well before Netflix guidelines, I think, were commonly used by so many people. And of course, we, and especially Jorge in person, were in close contact with Netflix and we were allowed to use and publish quite a bit of their material and guidelines on our website. I think their guidelines are certainly not the worst. So if you don't have access to academic guidelines, I don't see why you shouldn't use Netflix guidelines when you're teaching. as long as you identify them for what they are, and as long as students learning know these are guidelines by one commercial enterprise, so they're not necessarily what you always want to do in all circumstances, and they will also be commerce driven. So not all the decisions taken in their guidelines are necessarily underpinned by research and the best solutions. But I have no problem with people using Netflix guidelines. I think in some ways Netflix can be problematic, but in other ways it has been a game changer, also in positive ways for the industry.
I think it's important to include it in teaching, to, like you say, Aline, to make students aware of different type of guidelines, commercial ones versus other, and that they can also look at them critically.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mention them at all in teaching, they might be confronted with it later in their professional life. So I think it's important to
sure.
to include it and, you know, also be critical about them. But yeah.
No, but what I meant is that many people, at least maybe in informal context, but they just take those guidelines and that's the only thing they use to teach subtitling. And then many students, well, they can really tell the difference when they need to do something different from what's on those guidelines. I mean, if you're dealing with direct clients or actually with other companies like Amazon or Disney or whatever, they have differences with those guidelines. So
yes, of course. Yeah, I agree. That's why I said when you use them or use them for teaching, you have to specify what they are and where they come from.
Sure.
And that you can't just use them across the board because that would be problematic. Also, because personally, I don't agree with all their guidelines. You know, I agree with some, but certainly not with all of them.
Yeah, of course.
On the other hand, I think it's an advantage that they make them public to such extent.
Sure.
In the past, they were always a secret.
Mm-hmm.
I had to bend over backwards to get the guidelines of our public broadcaster here.
Mm.
And it was worse with the commercial broadcasters. I mean, they just wouldn't give us their guidelines in the beginning. And that gradually changed. I never understood why they were so secret.
Mm.
But they seemed to think they were private property, and I needed to explain to them that it would be good for the students to learn the guidelines so that when they hired somebody, they would at least hire somebody who knew some guidelines.
Of course.
So it changed generally. But in the beginning, it was a big secret. And also in the UK, it wasn't just a problem here in Belgium.
Yeah. I think that BBC was the only one that was available at some point. But I think we still have some secrecy because it's not easy to find guidelines for Disney or Amazon or whatever unless you're working with them. So,
okay. So if you agree, we can stop the first part of the interview here. We will keep the second part shorter because there was so much coming up in this part, but that's perfectly fine. So now let's listen to Guillermo's subtítulos con carácter.
A todos los subtítulos les faltan caracteres, pero a los mejores nunca les falta personalidad. ¿Qué los hace tan especiales? Quédate y descúbrelo con Guillermo Parra. Bienvenido a Subtítulos con Carácter.
Saludos, curiosos y amantes de los subtítulos. Hoy voy a dedicar la sección a la última película de Pixar, Turning Red, conocida en España como Red a secas y en Latinoamérica como Volviéndose Rojo. Y como ya es costumbre, en los títulos de Pixar se nota que ha habido un trabajo detrás de adaptación de muchos de los elementos gráficos de la película. Esto es algo que el estudio hace mucho y que, por ejemplo, también se ha visto en películas de Warner o en otras producciones de Marvel, pero que en general es mucho menos habitual en cine no animado, lo que llaman live action, básicamente por todas las posibilidades que ofrece la animación para reemplazar elementos, porque al fin y al cabo los han construido ellos mismos desde cero. Esta adaptación puede ser de diversos tipos, puede ser simplemente cultural, como es el caso que describe Sherzad Suria en su blog En la Luna de Babel, donde habla de la película Inside Out, del revés o intensamente, en la que se reemplazaba una verdura o un deporte para adaptar la película al público meta, al público al que iba dirigido en cada caso. Pero más allá de las diferencias culturales, la adaptación puede ser también a nivel lingüístico, y ese es el caso de Turning Red, donde a menudo aparece texto en pantalla, que normalmente se subtitularía, pero que justamente en la versión española de la película se ha traducido y se ha reemplazado de forma que no queda rastro de la versión inglés, como si la película estuviera originalmente en español y dirigida a nosotros. Este enfoque, curiosamente, no se ha aplicado en la versión latinoamericana, no sé si por cuestiones logísticas, económicas, donde sí que se utilizan subtítulos para los mensajes más relevantes que aparecen en pantalla. Por mencionar algunas escenas que me llaman la atención, ahora me viene a la cabeza un momento en el que la protagonista está con sus amigas en el instituto, se están pasando notitas y esas notitas, cuando las abren, están en español. En español en la versión de España, y en la versión latinoamericana, a pesar de que están en inglés, los subtítulos tienen un valor añadido, y es que imitan el uso de mayúsculas y minúsculas y el lenguaje coloquial en el que están redactadas las notas. Entonces empieza con minúscula, en vez de escribir que pone Q simplemente, o sip en vez de sí, imitando el yup inglés, e incluso hay palabras enteras escritas en mayúscula dentro del texto escrito en minúsculas, ¿no? Todo esto le da al texto pues más autenticidad, desde luego. También me ha llamado la atención una invitación de cumpleaños que estaba traducida para España con todos sus elementos: cumpleaños de Tyler, viernes, 19 horas, invitado especial, panda, pero que a la hora de subtitularla para Latinoamérica, claro, se queda limitada a las dos líneas: cumpleaños de Tyler, conoce a Panda. Y esto me hace reflexionar sobre hasta qué punto hay algunas limitaciones que nos autoimponemos en la subtitulación al hablar de velocidad de lectura y demás, cuando en textos convencionales no subtitulados todos estos elementos no se tienen en cuenta y no por ello va en detrimento del público. Y por último, tengo un ejemplo que yo creo que demuestra que no es oro todo lo que reluce y que este tipo de versiones y adaptaciones también tienen sus limitaciones. Cuando se ve la versión subtitulada en España, hay un momento en el que un personaje agarra una sudadera del suelo donde lee Fur Baby, pero en realidad no pone Fur Baby, pone Bebé Panda, porque recuerdo, en España este texto se ha adaptado. Digamos que el texto se lo saca un poco de la manga. Y en Latinoamérica, en la versión doblada, lee Bebé Peludo, pese a que en la sudadera pone Fur Baby. Así que estamos en las mismas. Por ahora, dependiendo de dónde estemos y de la versión que veamos, es inevitable que nos encontremos con estas cosas. Y aquí lo dejamos por ahí. Recordad que si queréis seguir al tanto de novedades en subtitulación, podéis seguirme tanto en Twitter como en Instagram y estar atentos al hashtag subtítulos con carácter. Gracias por escuchar y hasta el próximo episodio.
Okay, we are back from Guillermo's section, and now we will be talking about audio description. Nina, your thesis was about this access service, and I wanted to ask you, for those unfamiliar with it, whether you could define it briefly.
Yes, okay. So audio description is a service that makes audiovisual content pre-recorded or live accessible to people who for different reasons cannot see what is happening in the visual, mostly for people who have a visual impairment. That is a primary target group, but it can be targeted to anyone who for whatever reason, a temporary problem or the context, you know, multitasking and not seeing the screen, cannot access the visuals. In the most traditional form, it's a type of translation where then a voice is added that describes the visual elements in between sounds and dialogue. But in recent, more creative forms, it can have different forms. For instance, an actor on stage integrating the descriptions in the performance.
Okay, it is not easy to
design AD these days. No.
Exactly, but I think that is a very good introduction for anyone who is curious and have never heard of it. So thank you for that. And as I was saying, your thesis, which was directed by Aline, was very well recognized internationally. We know that you were awarded the EST Young Scholar Prize, so congratulations for that.
Thank you.
In 2019. And it was a very innovative piece of research. I think especially because of the methodology that you adopted. Could you tell us a little bit about what you did?
Yes. So it was a study on the language of audio description, and the main focus was using corpus linguistic techniques to study a set of, I think there were 39 films with audio description focused on Dutch. Because the hypothesis was that because of this very specific context, the language that describers use is very specific, different from other types of language such as subtitling or novels. And so with statistics and corporate linguistics tools, we analyzed the language and indeed found certain grammatical, syntactical structures, a typical word use that is you know, very much the language of AD. But of course, it's, you know, audio description is more than just language. There's also the original film, there's sounds. So it became clear along the way that there's a very important multimodal dimension there as well, interaction with sounds. So the second part of the analysis tried to look at these results of, you know, typical AD language against the soundtrack and multimodal aspects of audio description to see how, you know, sound and language interact to create the film. So yeah, that's, I think, in a nutshell.
Thank you. Yes. And I know you posted a summary of the thesis online. Mm-hmm. I will also make that available for anyone interested in learning some more. So thanks. And what about what you are doing now regarding AD? You have already told us a little bit at the beginning, but perhaps you can elaborate on that. For example, you mentioned some new PhD students. So
yeah.
What kind of thesis are you supervising?
Yeah.
What are your current projects?
So one of the projects that I'm supervising now actually, you know, stemmed from my PhD thesis, because the language of audio description turned out to be very, very specific, very specific type of constructions that occur very frequently. So that kind of created the hypothesis that this type of language would be an ideal candidate for machine translation, given that there's also a lot of content, audio described content in English, but not so much in Dutch or other smaller languages. So the idea of you know, translating audio descriptions to, you know, as a quick way to increase the offer and also making English content accessible, and, you know, using maybe machine translation to that purpose, because of course there's always a feasibility issue of how much content can be made accessible with describers from scratch. So there is now a PhD student, Kim Steyert, working on that and looking into, you know, to what the quality of machine translation at this point is for audio description, and also what the multimodal, you know, context of AD, the fact that it's from visuals to visual elements to verbal, what impact that has on the post-editing process.
What is their name, or is there anything published so that people can find them?
Yes, well, Kim Steyert is the student working on it. She has a page on the website as well, and we recently, I think, yeah, this only 1 or 2 months ago, published a first article on the topic. So I can send that information as well for you to share.
Perfect. No, I mean, people can just look it up. It was just to so that it was more traceable.
Yeah, I think it's an open access publication. So if you just Google it, you'll probably find it.
Perfect. Yes. Guillermo wants to say something.
Yeah, I have a question, Nina. Recently, in social media, I read a post by a blind user she was complaining about audio description being too objective, so focusing too much on objective descriptions that don't say, like, that can be very worthy to describe something that's as simple as smiling or as simple as an expressing an emotion. What's your take on the use of subjectivity in audio description? Is there a place for it? Is it used in different cultures?
Difficult question too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about it, especially because when you said about, when you suggested, well, when you said that you're researching machine translation being applied to audio description from English That's what I think I understood. So would you say that in different cultures, it could be perceived differently in the sense that perhaps a very objective description is acceptable in one country, but not in a different one?
Yes, lots of questions in one question and lots of big topics. No, yeah, that's definitely one thing. There are cultural differences. It's still a hypothesis, but part of the research is also that we kind of know from experience that English descriptions are a bit more dense, maybe worthier than what maybe we would do in Dutch. So that's definitely something we'll see in the research to what extent, this is changed by describers. So we're going to do an experiment comparing translation from scratch by professional describers and also what they change in post-editing. And there we will also see to what extent, you know, they just change things that are just, you know, wrong on a linguistic level, but they might also introduce changes to fit to more local norms and conventions. But there is indeed more research to be done, you know, comparing different languages. In terms of objectivity, subjectivity, well, yes, there is a place for subjectivity. I don't like the the objective-subjective kind of terminology because I think it's all subjective to some extent. You know, you always write from a certain perspective. And depending on the context, you can be more extreme in that sense. I prefer the term explicitation. To what extent do you, you know, just leave it up to the audience to infer certain meanings, to what extent do you explicitate, and there's many reasons to explicitate. Can be guidelines, can be personal choice, can depend on the genre, it can simply be because you don't have a lot of time, you know, saying somebody is smiling is much quicker than describing what happens with the face. You need more words.
Yeah.
So I think it's just different strategies that fit different contexts, and I think particularly these days, for the different genres, there is more room for subjectivity, certainly in theater. And I'm also working on studying dance audio description, and there just describing what you see simply doesn't make sense because it, you know what happens, but there's no aesthetic value in the descriptions. So I think there's a lot of things going on there in practice that go way beyond the, you know, traditional describe what you see approach. And there's a lot of room for research to see, you know, what, when, and how this can be done. I think I answered the main questions in your loaded question.
Yeah, no, that was lovely.
We are exploiting you too today.
Can I add one small thing about this AD issue?
Of course.
Just really short. I think maybe that we should look more at the way the plays, for instance, we audio describe or surtitle, are changing, and in what way that affects how we produce audio descriptions. Because, for instance, in Flemish theatre, plays are becoming much more experience-oriented rather than narrative-oriented. So there's no point making a narrative audio description of a play that doesn't want to be narrative. And I think maybe our research should collaborate more with theatre studies and other disciplines that give us better insight in what is happening to the content that we are rendering accessible, because that's changing quickly too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also that kind of collaboration is also the reason that there's more possibilities in description now, in the sense before, as a describer in theater, for instance, you know, you worked independently, you got a recording, you visited, and you wrote your own description. While now there's more collaboration also in practice with makers and theaters, which opens up possibilities to explicitly choose for a more subjective approach, because that approach is not just a choice by the describer, because it is inspired by the input from makers. So, you know, interdisciplinary collaboration in research and practice opens up new avenues for different types of AD, and I think there's a place for all types, depending on the context.
You are now talking about theater, AD, and I know that you both have worked a lot on that. Could you tell us some of the main challenges entailed in live events such as a theater play?
So the main challenges, it ties in, I think, with what Aline just said, that also theater and live performances are are changing a lot in the way they are made. They are creating experiences. There's also a lot of crossover between genres. You know, there was opera and dance and theater, but now there's opera performances with a lot of dance by famous choreographers, and there's different types of experiences. So it's impossible to find one way to make this accessible that fits all. It's very much becoming work made to measure, finding a strategy for accessibility that works for that particular performance. Also taking into account that there's more technological options for audio description, integrating it in the performances, open audio description, the traditional headphone audio description. There's now apps for semi-live or pre-recorded AD, also for live theater, and all these different, you know, agents, human and non-human agents, impact on how you describe and what is possible. So I think the biggest challenge is that it's a very, finding a new and creative AD solution that fits that context, for which it's very difficult to have this very clear checklist type guidelines. You know, there are certain principles, but it's very much finding a solution fit for each context, which is challenging, but also I think very exciting, because it's why this is such a creative type of translation and what attracted me to studying this in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Aline, would you like to add anything or?
No, I think that basically covers it. I think I agree there. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
And just to finish, with audio description and accessibility, perhaps more in general. I know that you've been involved in some projects connecting accessibility and the health crisis. Would you like to tell us some about that?
Yes. So it's. I think the project finishes in 2 weeks, actually. We're in the final stages. It was a one-year project that was actually an initiative by a colleague from linguistics. That was funded by the Flemish government, the Belgian government on national level, because early on in the COVID pandemic, it became clear that, you know, communication was a very important tool in battling the pandemic, but communication was not always accessible, and there were lots of groups that suffered communication vulnerabilities for several reasons, not being able to access the official communication, sometimes linguistic barriers, not speaking the official languages of a country, but also more, you know, textual levels, not having, the literacy level to follow some of the complex health communication, sometimes also, you know, social context, not being digitally literate, and therefore in this digital age, not accessing information, but of course also accessibility issues for people with sensory impairments. So we started looking into, you know, what the barriers are, particularly in the Belgian context, what can be improved. And it was, you know, also a practice project trying to develop new types of accessibility, helping the crisis center that did the translations to increase the accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
And the end goal of the project, which is now finished, is to have a set of policy guidelines, recommendation on how also in the future communication can be made more accessible from the start. Because I think the main takeaway from the project was that there is simply very, very little research on inclusive communication for various target groups in a crisis context. And the traditional guidelines and input we have is often for comes from film and entertainment, and is not always fit for a context where you have to communicate very, very fast to a very diverse and wide audience. So a very, you know, typical a new set of challenges, but of course accessibility is crucial there as well.
And also a very timely project. We were using this word before, but indeed I think it has become very clear that accessibility needed to expand in the context of the crisis. So thank you for sharing this research experience with us.
And now we will be closing the interview, even though we would like to keep you with us forever to keep talking about these things, by briefly commenting on training. So perhaps Nina, since you are now active in teaching, what do you think is missing in, or perhaps I am very negative in making the question, but I can ask it more generally. Do you think there is anything missing, or do you think there are substantial contributions in training when it comes to AVT and media accessibility? In Europe, for example, if you want to focus on that, or even in your own, at your own university. So what do you think could be changed? What do you implement in your classes? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think it's not so much that I feel there's something's missing, more that there's so much opportunities and new skills to learn, and there's new skills coming every day that are relevant for accessibility professionals. It's difficult to choose in a one semester course what you focus on. So I think for the future it's a challenge to see what are the basic skills for an audio describer, for instance, depending on what area of specialization they might move into. So I think there's a very varied skill set there for accessibility professionals. And now in Antwerp, there's a few courses on AVT and accessibility that students can choose. But I think there's already enough to make a full master in media accessibility. I think that would be one of my dream, that we would have a separate master where I could dive into in more detail into the many different profiles of audio describers for different genres, and also for what Aline said for subtitling. There's so many new things, new technologies, new profiles. It's becoming a vast and complex area, so a lot to teach. So I think it's a challenge now in my teaching, to mm-hmm. not so much decide what do I include, but what do I leave out?
We asked Aline to write that book, and we can ask you to launch that master's. I mean, we are happy to ask you to do things in this podcast, so that would be great, yes.
Yeah, and I think mm-hmm. the second thing that I'm just thinking of now is what we said earlier. I think also making our teaching more mm-hmm. accessible in itself, and our university courses and their accessibility. I think that's also definitely a challenge and something I think some European projects are also studying. So,
mm-hmm. And Aline, one last question. What recommendations do you have for prospective trainees who would like to focus on subtitling or audio description?
I think I would advise them not to focus on either one or the other, mm-hmm. or not to limit themselves to one form of AVT. I think they should put together a portfolio that includes both traditional AVT forms and their variants, plus media accessibility. I think it's important for them to put together or to try and attend and learn in an interdisciplinary curriculum. For instance, taking courses from other departments or even faculties, like interpreting or film studies or even IT or economy or accessibility. Interpreting, I'm saying, because I'm convinced that many forms of AVT and interpreting will gradually grow closer to each other, because interpreters are using more and more technology and more audiovisual technology, and I think our paths will cross more and more. But that's just one example. I think in general, the wider or the more different variants you are familiar with, the more flexible you can be. And a very, very good knowledge of IT and computing, or enough to really work well as a practitioner so that you can solve all technical problems. And that doesn't just hold for subtitling and for working in the AVT industry. It's just as important in audio description for the theater, because very often you have to solve technical problems there as well that the technicians aren't able to solve, or there is no technician there and you can't just stop providing audio description. So I think as more modes continue to diversify and be implemented in different contexts, you have to develop flexibility and an attitude that embraces change and a willingness to keep learning. So lifelong learning, I think, is important. It's something Nina also mentioned earlier when we were having a chat, actually.
Okay, so thank you. I think this will be the end to the interview, but as I said before, we will need to invite you back in some time and keep on exploiting you, because we've learned a lot and we are grateful for your attendance, virtual attendance to this podcast and for accompanying us today. So thank you, Nina and Aline, and see you soon.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being with us.
Cámaras y computadoras listas. Llegó el momento de experimentar. Entremos en el laboratorio audiovisual con Damián Santilli.
Les doy la bienvenida al laboratorio audiovisual número 28. Hoy vamos a hablar de cómo agregar subtítulos a videos con el editor de videos pago Camtasia. Esta es la primera vez que hablamos en esta sección de un editor de videos pago, pero me pareció interesante comenzar con Camtasia porque es una herramienta muy amigable que podemos usar los profesionales de la traducción para hacer ediciones simples para clientes directos y que, además, no tiene un costo tan alto como otras alternativas que son mucho más complejas de utilizar. Si les interesa aprender a usar esta herramienta, les recomiendo que lo hagan directamente desde el sitio web oficial de TechSmith, la empresa que desarrolla este software. En el laboratorio de hoy vamos a suponer que los conocimientos básicos ya los tenemos. Para incorporar subtítulos tenemos varias opciones. La primera es agregar los subtítulos uno por uno, pero en formato de texto normal, lo que nos permitirá jugar con los tamaños, colores y efectos. Las otras dos opciones son las que nos permiten crear subtítulos convencionales. La segunda, entonces, implica agregar los subtítulos uno por uno como en un programa de edición de subtítulos tradicional. La tercera opción es agregar directamente un archivo SRT. Empecemos por esta opción. Una vez que tenemos un video en el espacio de trabajo, vamos a ir a la opción Captions de la barra lateral de la izquierda y hacemos clic en la ruedita que aparece arriba a la izquierda y seleccionamos Import Captions. Solo nos permite importar archivos SRT, así que debemos tenerlo en ese formato. Buscamos el SRT temporizado que se corresponda con el video y lo seleccionamos. Automáticamente veremos todos los subtítulos alineados en el espacio de trabajo con el video y, al reproducir el video, veremos cómo van apareciendo con cualquier programa de subtitulado. Si hacemos clic en la cajita de algún subtítulo, podremos cambiar el tipo de letra, tamaños y otras opciones. Una vez terminamos de hacer todos los cambios y ponemos la opción de exportar el video para generar el video nuevo con subtítulos, en la solapa Options debemos configurar el Caption Type y elegir entre las diferentes opciones, por ejemplo, Burned In Captions si queremos que pegue los subtítulos al video. Con esta opción y con la que veremos a continuación, el tipo de letra, tamaño, color y demás opciones es igual para todos los subtítulos. Algunas opciones, igualmente como la cursiva, sí pueden aplicarse individualmente, por supuesto. La opción de insertar los subtítulos uno por uno funciona desde el mismo panel que antes, pero en vez de ir a Import Caption, simplemente hacemos clic en el botón verde que aparece abajo y dice Add Caption y agregamos el subtítulo como en cualquier programa. Lo hacemos, por supuesto, uno por uno. Por último, vamos a hablar de la posibilidad de insertar texto en pantalla que pueda funcionar como subtítulo. Esto se hace desde el menú Annotations, Callouts. Nos permite esta opción colocar texto en cualquier lugar de la pantalla e incluso hacer animaciones que nos van a dar la posibilidad de que un mismo subtítulo ingrese en pantalla de apartes, como siguiendo palabra por palabra lo que va diciendo un personaje, lo cual es útil sobre todo en closed caption. Camtasia es una herramienta muy práctica para quienes no tenemos grandes conocimientos de edición de video y recomiendo mucho aprender a usarla y tenerla como una herramienta más, porque nos puede servir para resolver problemas para nuestros clientes con ediciones sencillas de video que además podemos cobrar aparte y a una muy buena tarifa. Y hasta aquí llegamos con el laboratorio audiovisual de hoy. Pueden seguirme y ponerse en contacto en mi cuenta de Instagram, @tradugeek, o en Twitter en d-santilli. Hasta la próxima. Bueno, muy bien, y ya estamos aquí en el final del episodio de hoy. Excelente, las secciones, excelente la entrevista, Blanca. ¿Con qué te quedas del capítulo de hoy?
A mí me ha gustado mucho ese momento en el que Aline Remal nos ha hablado de lo importante de diversificar en la traducción, y en general me parece que son dos invitadas a las que vamos a tener que volver a llamar para que nos hablen de más cosas, porque creo que toda la parte, por ejemplo, de respeaking que ha trabajado Aline no la hemos podido cubrir hoy. Así que nada, me queda pendiente saber más, poder volver a contactar con ellas y seguir un ratito charlando con ellas.
Yo creo que del episodio lo que me llevo es algo que habla bien de nosotros nada más, así que no voy a hablar bien de Aline y de Nina, sino que es que la verdad que increíble la entrevista que conseguimos, no solo poder llegar a tener la entrevista, sino lo bien que ha salido y todos los temas que se pudieron tocar. Pienso que me pongo del otro lado, del lado de los oyentes, y la verdad es que para quienes, como siempre digo, ¿no?, cuando uno pone recursos gratuitos a disposición, para quienes sepan aprovecharlos, sepan utilizarlos, sepan llevarse cosas y tomar nota, porque esto es, la verdad que lo de estas chicas fue una clase, digamos, una cosa de locos. Sí. Y que uno dice, bueno, si vos escuchás el episodio y te llevas dos o tres cosas de todo lo que se contó, para investigar, para leer, para interesarte, aunque no vayas a trabajar por ahí ni en audiodescripción, ni en rehablado, me parece que es importante. Y bueno, la verdad que yo a Nina la conocí en el Languages and the Media, no la conocía a Aline, por supuesto, la conozco desde que la primera vez que tomé contacto con la Biblia, desde que pude leer los primeros versos y los primeros capítulos. Ahí está. Ahí me entré en contacto con ella, y la verdad es que el libro que escribieron con Jorge y Jacinta, o sea, podría haber hecho solamente eso, Aline, y ya hubiera quedado para la historia, y sin embargo hizo 3 millones de cosas más y sigue haciendo y sigue publicando. Así que sí. Aplausos para nosotros, porque esta entrevista, desde el punto de vista de producción y de lo que fue la entrevista, bueno, aplausos principalmente para Blanca.
Para Blanca, eso iba a decir yo, sí.
No, Guille, o sea, Blanca se llevó todos los laureles.
Totalmente.
Agradecimiento a las invitadas que han aceptado venir, sobre todo. Sí.
No, y a mí además, no sé si es cosa de que Aline está jubilada, pero me ha transmitido una tranquilidad también con su forma de hablar y con ese inglés.
Sí. Es intérprete, se nota.
Sí, se nota.
Sí.
Que yo a Nina cada vez que la escucho flipo también, así que espero que la podamos seguir invitando acá o escucharla en algún otro momento, en otro lugar. Y bueno, y hasta aquí llegamos con el episodio de hoy. Recuerden visitar el sitio web de nuestro patrocinador una.net y registrarse para las 4 semanas de pruebas. Recuerden también participar del concurso de Una para ganarse el pasaje y todo pago para Languages and the Media, y también recuerden que pueden encontrar toda la información de este podcast en nuestro sitio web www.ensincroniapodcast.com y también en nuestro canal de YouTube, y que nos pueden encontrar a nosotros tres en LinkedIn, Twitter e Instagram. Hasta la próxima.